At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I talk to Emily Andrew about her experience of binge drinking and how this impacted and intertwined with her relationship with food and struggling with bulimia. This episode was really insightful to think about the nuance of somebody's relationship with alcohol as well as their relationship with food. And I think it's so important that we continue to have these nuanced and individualised conversations.
Anyway, hello. After all that chaos, it's so nice to see you again.
I know, it's so lovely to see you too. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thank you. I've actually had such a productive day. I yesterday had so many things I wanted to achieve because I'm home alone this weekend, and I didn't feel in the mood to do any of them. And so I was just like, it's okay, like I'll just have like a self-care day, like got my nails done and saw a friend for coffee. And then today I woke up and I was like, today's the day, and I've done everything I wanted to do, and it's not even 3 o'clock yet, so I'm very happy.
Amazing.
How are you?
That's just what we want. Yeah, no, I'm good, thank you. It's a Sunday and I have a two-year-old, so it's about as good as it gets.
Amazing. Well, I'm super excited to chat to you today. I think this was a podcast that I had a request to record. People were speaking about like their relationship with alcohol, particularly like binge drinking and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm very excited to speak to you. So I guess for the listeners, do you just want to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Emily Andrew. I am an advanced EFT practitioner and eating disorder practitioner, and I am actually training at the moment to be a cognitive behavioral hypnotherapist as well, to add an extra little qualification.
Amazing.
There. So I work a lot with eating disorders and disordered eating. I also work on a more wide kind of view with things like phobias, fears, anxiety, those kind of things with EFT. But essentially, a lot of the work that I do is really about helping people to overcome the stuff that's keeping them stuck in a really curious, compassionate way, and giving them the tools to really start to live their life as they'd like to live it.
It sounds brilliant, and I've loved watching your work and watching you grow, because I think that it's just been so refreshing to see somebody with such like a positive mindset and really making a difference. But I guess we did an episode separately on EFT, but just in case people don't know, can you just tell us a little bit about what it is? Because I feel like it will be relevant to this episode when we're talking.
Yeah, absolutely. So EFT stands for Emotional Freedom Techniques. It is a combination between a somatic, which is tapping on acupressure points, and the cognitive. So that could be cognitive statements, it could be exposure. And essentially what it does is it helps to work really deeply in the body. So it helps to affect our amygdala, which is our stress center in our body, helps to bring that activation down when we're activated. It helps to reduce blood pressure, cortisol levels, it changes DNA expression. It works really deeply, but the result of that basically means that when we're emotionally activated, whether that's where, you know, we're feeling extremely stressed about something, or perhaps when we go through something quite traumatic, triggers, etc., it helps to bring those down, bring the emotional intensity down out of that, so then we can make a choice of how we want to act. So as an example of the way that I use it with clients, with my eating disorder clients, is when we're thinking about fear foods. So fear foods, there's often emotional attachments to that, even if we're not really entirely sure what they are. And what you can do is you can use EFT. It's kind of reverse cravings work, and you can reduce the fear and the anxiety around that food, so that then they can have the choice of whether they want to kind of reintegrate that food back into their life and their lifestyle. So it essentially helps to emotionally free you from the stuff that's holding you back.
Wow. It all sounds way too good to be true. Like, I think, you know, that intensity of that fear around whatever is holding you back from, like, you know, moving on from an eating disorder or eating a certain food, it sounds amazing to have that freedom to not have that anxiety anymore.
And I think that's something that's really important to, you know, it's not a magic tool. You know, it's not, I don't proclaim eating EFT to be the solution for all eating disorders. You know, they're complex, just as addictions are, but it can make the journey a lot easier. You know, it isn't a magic pill where, you know, you might do a couple of sessions with me on a particular food and then, you know, suddenly the eating disorder goes away. But it helps to just minimize some of the aspects. So, for example, if a client that I worked with, they had real anxiety around the mealtime environment. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we tapped on when the anxiety came in. So when did that start? We tapped on that. That was when they got called to dinner. Okay, so we tapped on that. We ended up bringing the anxiety down. The next time they went and had their meal, they noticed that the anxiety was down, but it came back when the thought of an empty plate came in. So then we did a bit more tapping on that. That helped to reduce some of the anxiety around that. And obviously, there's other emotions involved. I'm just really simplifying it. But we did maybe three sessions, and the client reported that for the first time since they were ill, they were able to eat an entire meal. So that's just, you know, that's one case and that's one instance, but that is one instance against the eating disorder. Mm-hmm. You know, it's proof that not only they can do it, but they can do it without the extreme anxiety that comes with it. So it's a tool, essentially. It's not a miracle. It's not a miracle working kind of pill or magical device, but it is a tool that some people find that is really helpful for them in their recovery journey.
And I think it's so important to highlight that, isn't it? Because I don't think there's any one thing that is like a magic fix for eating disorder recovery. It's a concoction of lots of different things, which is what makes it so challenging. But I think, you know, having tools in your back pocket that allow you to reduce that level of anxiety when you're doing something that maybe you haven't done for a while or really does bring up a lot of emotion for you, that is so important to have. I always call it my like recovery toolbox, to have lots of things in there that I can sort of, you know, pardon the pun, tap into for when situations arise. If things are feeling difficult. And I think, you know, like you said there, whilst it is only maybe, you know, that one situation that you worked on with a client, I think the really good thing about something like EFT is, yes, again, you tapped into that and reduced the anxiety for that, and then they took that forwards, but then they can also take that skill into other difficult times, difficult behaviors, and tap into that as well to reduce the anxiety. So it's something that, like, you know, just because you're doing it for that one behavior doesn't mean that you can't take it elsewhere and work on different things as well.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, as a practitioner, I don't just use EFT. You know, I bring in lots of other modalities because it is an integrative approach, and that's really important. And yeah, I think the reason why I am so passionate about EFT is because it's a tool. Once you learn it, you've learned it. It's the world is your oyster in terms of what you apply it to. You know, it can be eating disorder recovery, but it can also be, you know, public speaking. It can be goal setting. It can be, you know, just trying to bring your emotional frequency up, like all of those things. Like it can be a really fun thing that you can take into any kind of area, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And how did you start in EFT? What got you into it?
It was through my eating disorder training. So when I was training as an eating disorder practitioner, they kind of talked about the importance of having like lots of different tools, and they talked about this EFT thing, and I thought, that's never heard of it, thought it was a bit weird. But there was something in me that just kind of went, I might as well just train in it and see. So I started the course, and when I first started it, I wasn't very convinced, because I was like, how is tapping on your face going to stop you from having a phobia of a dog? Like, how is that going to happen? And I didn't get the understanding of it in that first lot of training that I went through. So I thought, right, I'm going to research it. So I'm going to go and I'm going to research it. And I just inhaled EFT research. And the more I learned, the more I thought, there's something in this that I want to give a go. And as part of your practitioner training, you have to do 50 hours with over 25 different people. So I just opened it up for free. I just said, right, anyone that's got anything, just come and work with me. And I did so many different things: cravings work, depression, anxiety, phobias, trauma, like so much stuff. And every single session, every single person out of those 50 hours, apart from one person that said they might need a little bit more, felt a benefit from that session.
Wow.
You know, I'm not saying we totally, like, you know, yeah, one session cured somebody of their phobia of flying, but that one actually did. But the other one, you know, I'm not saying one session is a wonder, but it was just amazing that, you know, people felt that kind of benefit just from quite a short interval of kind of therapeutic work.
Yeah.
And then the rest was history. I was like, right, well, this is what I'm doing then. I'm going to be an advanced practitioner. I'm going to keep training, and yeah, love it.
And you are now, I mean, to me anyway, like the queen of EFT. Like, if I think EFT, I literally think of you. Like, it's particularly, obviously, like, I'm in the eating disorder circle, but I'm like, that is Emily's jam. Like, that is what Emily does. So, yeah, I absolutely always think of you. And it's funny as well, because I think I mentioned this to you when we spoke before, but my mum had EFT years and years ago, and she had a weird, well, I say weird, I probably shouldn't say that, but basically she had a phobia of ripped or wet tissue. And so much so that, like, you know, if we went to a swimming bath, like, she'd really struggle in case there was toilet paper there, or like if we went out for dinner and someone had left a napkin, like, she couldn't sit at the table. And it sounds, you know, when I say it to someone, they're like, you know, is she all right? Like, what have you? But it was crippling for her, and it was really affecting her. And she had EFT, and she now, if there's a bit of ripped tissue on the table, like, one time she did actually even pick it up, which I thought was just incredible. But most of the time she's just like, oh, Hannah, would you mind just moving that? And it's like, that's amazing, because she used to be paralyzed by it, and now she can just say, oh, can you just sort that? And it's totally fine. So yeah, I think EFT is like such a good tool to have in your back pocket. And like you say, just so transferable into different things.
Yeah, 100%. And it's not, there's no weird phobias. I mean, I had to tap through my phobia of nail files. So, you know, like, I think the thing is as well, we can look at and this is quite apt for what we're going to talk about as well, but we can look at the thing, which is, you know, a fear of wet tissue, but there's always something underneath it. There's always something more than that. And actually, there is no weird phobia. There is no weird behavior. You know, what I always say with my clients, especially with eating disorders, there's nothing that I haven't heard or probably done myself. Mm-hmm. Obviously, myself having an eating disorder for a decade when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, instead of trying to look at just the behavior and trying to change that, actually, sometimes it can be really useful to understand what's behind it, what that behavior is trying to solve or trying to manage or deal with, and then actually being able to kind of compassionately adjust that so that the behavior isn't so needed anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's the thing, you know, when I was just saying about my mum's ripped tissue, like, and it's the same with eating disorders. It's not the actual thing that's the issue. It's, you know, a traumatic event that might have occurred, or it's a coping mechanism for something. which I think is so common, and often we just like look at the behavior rather than digging underneath, which is so important, which nicely brings us on to what we were going to chat about today. So we had a request from quite a few listeners, actually, particularly during Dry January, to talk about binge drinking and people's relationship with alcohol. And personally, I find this a really interesting topic because I come from a place where I don't think that I have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, apart from when I'm like really struggling emotionally. And if I'm in a social situation, I will start drinking and then be like, oh, I feel better about myself now. And then I won't be able to stop. But if I haven't started, then I'm okay. But equally on the other side, it's a difficult relationship to navigate because for me, cutting out alcohol also means cutting out calories, and there's the fear of calories in alcohol. So actually sometimes having a drink is beating the eating disorder in a weird way, but then obviously there's the complexity of kind of numbing and things like that. So that's sort of my 360 view of it. But I really wanted to speak to you about your experience. So do you mind sharing with the listeners what your experience has been with alcohol?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love this as well because it is such a nuanced conversation. Mm-hmm. So my experience, I alluded to it before, I myself have struggled with eating disorders from probably the age of around 14, 15. I had anorexia and that later developed into bulimia. And so it got to a point where I was hospitalized when I was 21. I've been kind of recovered for around 10 years now. So I've kind of been in it, out of it, as long as I was in it, if that makes sense. Which is quite a wonderful feeling. But for me, essentially, the way that alcohol played a part in that was very much a kind of accompanying my kind of binge purge cycles quite a lot of the time. And I never thought I had a problem with alcohol because I was kind of using it in a way of my eating disorder. But what I found when I did kind of, I kind of came away from bulimia was that I started to use alcohol in the same way that I used my eating disorder. Mm. And so there was and it was really interesting because, you know, I'd been out of recovery, technically, but whenever I drank, there was a side of the eating disorder that was still there. It was like the ghost of the eating disorder a little bit. And it was quite hard for me to admit that because I was like, but I'm better now. Like, you know, I'm starting to live my life and, you know, all of this stuff. But then I noticed that there was the same kind of patterning of, I want to feel numb. You know, I don't want to feel anything. I don't want to think anymore. And I wasn't drinking, you know, every day. I wasn't, and I feel like anyone who has had a problem with alcohol will always say this. I wasn't drinking every day. I didn't wake up and have, I didn't wake up and have a drink. But the way that I was approaching alcohol was becoming very problematic for me. So I ended up basically saying, I'm going to stop drinking for a year. I'm going to just try it and see. Because at that point in my life, I was like, well, you've got to have something. You can't be too healthy because that in itself is a bad problem. So you've got to drink because everybody else drinks. Mm. So I can't continue to justify it for a while, but I just thought, you know what, I'm going to have a year off. And I'm going to see what happens. And I quit on my birthday in April 2019. By October, I was off my anxiety medication. And I haven't drunk anything since. So it's 5 years later in April this year. And I haven't felt the need to drink again, just because the benefits for me have been so vast. And I was talking to my grandpa actually the other day, because we were talking about, you know, how I'd really struggled when I was younger. And he said, kind of, when when was it that you've actually, you know, felt really better? And it, and I thought about it, and actually, you know, I've been out of, in recovery or out of recovery, however we want to say it, you know, I haven't had needed any help for my eating disorder since I was 22, 23. But I would say I've only really felt truly free and really mentally well for the last 5 years, because I haven't had something to cope with life. I've had to work out how to cope with life myself. So yeah, that's kind of a mini roundup, but if you've got specific questions, please let's dive
in. I always have lots of questions. My mind is like no, I think it's, I mean, firstly, congratulations. And what would you say for, like, you know, when, on your anniversary, do you have like a specific word? Is it like happy birthday, happy
sober day? You can kind of say soberversary.
Okay, people, well, happy soberversary for April. That is fantastic. So, you know, amazing, well done. I think something that's really important to, like, that I always want to talk about in this sort of thing is that, once again, it's another behavior that it can be approached in life in a healthy way, and it also can be like an obsessive compulsive way. So, you know, I'm thinking about like exercise. Like, I mean, exercise is different because exercise has health benefits. You know, having a drink doesn't necessarily have health benefits, but you can just have like a couple with your friends and that makes you feel really happy, and then you move on with your life and that's fine. But like exercise, drinking can be something that is also very negative and addictive. And I think it's difficult because it's probably different for everybody. But did you have, or do you have, like, things in your mind that you think, that's how I can see how somebody would have like a quote unquote healthy relationship with alcohol, but then that's when it becomes unhealthy?
I think it is really nuanced. And the thing is that alcohol in itself, well, it depends what you take on it. Gabor Mate says that no drug is addictive. It's what predisposes the person to struggle with the addiction, you know, and that can be a brain thing, but it can also be a life thing. So, you know, it isn't necessarily, and I've always been really careful not to demonize alcohol, just as I don't demonize anything else, because I do think that is problematic. Because often what you'll find with people that quit drinking, they will then start to transfer their coping mechanism into food. People struggle with their relationship with food when they quit drinking. That's really common, and I see it all the time. And it's because the reason why they were drinking hasn't been addressed. They've just transferred it. So quite a lot of people who do struggle with their relationship with food, and they start to find that, you know, that's getting better, they might find that they're transferring that into alcohol or exercise, or, you know, so actually it's a really individual thing. But I think the question always to ask yourself is, what is this for? Because although, you know, the studies will say, oh, alcohol is good for your heart, or alcohol is bad for your heart, like there's always, you know, conflicting information there, but it is a social lubricant. And for some people who are in eating disorder recovery, that is something that they find really difficult. And so going and being part of the world again is a really key thing. So it's not helpful to be like, oh, now you've transferred, you know, now you're transferring that's not good. But it's about being able to really get curious with yourself and give yourself the compassion to be able to go, am I doing this because I'm trying not to feel something? Or am I doing this because I want to be part of something? Like, and I think it's always kind of a learning, and you check in with yourself. For me, I found that the more that I really sat with myself, I realized I couldn't cope with just being in my own head. that was something that I really struggled with. So it would be like, let's drink if there's a celebration. Let's drink if we've had a bad day. Let's drink because it's Friday, you know. And there was always a reason that took me further away from life instead of allowing it my like it to be a gate into life. So that was the thing for me where I thought, actually, all I'm doing here is just coming more into myself and not into my true self, just into this like bubble wrapped version of not feeling, not thinking self. And that was why I just thought, let's just try it for a year and then we'll see. And I'm still in the process of saying, well, we'll just see. Like, you know, I've never been one person that's particularly, you know, I know for me, because there was, and I don't know if there still is, but there was a side of myself that if I told myself I couldn't do something, then I'd immediately want to rebel. So there is that side of me, but I've often wondered, you know, is this a form of like being really controlled or being really restricted by not drinking? But actually for me, the life benefit for me of not drinking is much better than what I did have when I was.
Yeah. And I think that's such a good point. And I really like what you were saying there about, I think the experience can be different for everybody, but I think one thing that really clicked with me was you said about, does it like bring you into something or does it take you away from something? And for me, like having a drink with my friends is a really enjoyable moment. And that's, you know, something I really like. And sometimes it does allow me to just relax a little bit and to, you know, focus more on being around my friends rather than panicking about, you know, the calories in the drink or whatever. But I can also appreciate for some people that it's a soothing mechanism. And I think if that's your only way to self-soothe, then that's probably when it can be quite detrimental. But I'm exactly the same as you in that if I say to myself, you can't have that, then it's kind of all that's on my mind. And I think, you know, we only have to look at kind of the binge restrict cycle in terms of when people restrict something, your body then just absolutely hankers onto that and craves it. And then when you do end up having it, you have it in a much larger quantity. And something that I have been kind of doing with myself recently to explore whether choices I'm making are revolving around like health and well-being, like actual health and well-being, not kind of like, you know, the eating disorders idea of health and well-being, is to think, if I had a different option to this, would I choose it based on not how my eat? Basically, I'll give an example rather than what I'm trying to say, but I've been exploring my relationship with food, and I previously have been vegetarian, and I was trying to explore, am I vegetarian because of the animals and the planet and things like that, or am I vegetarian because it gives me an opportunity to restrict in certain situations? And I asked myself, if there was a chicken sandwich and a cheese sandwich, but the cheese sandwich was double the amount of calories than the chicken sandwich, which one would I have? And my answer at the time was a chicken sandwich. And I think the same thing for me, I try and do with alcohol is, and this is just my unique perspective, because for me, the thing that scares me about alcohol is the calories. I know that everybody will have like a whole host of different things, but if there's a non-alcoholic drink and an alcoholic drink, but the non-alcoholic drink is even the same amount of calories as the alcoholic drink, because I have to recognize the fact that I'm not going to get that slight little buzz from the alcoholic drink, which one would I have? And every time it's the alcoholic drink. So that to me says that the reason that I am trying to limit my alcohol consumption is all about calories rather than it being sort of a, you know, other aspects of not drinking alcohol that people might think about.
I think as well, when you were talking about, you know, going out and like being with friends and stuff, I think the experiment and the question as well is always like, could I do this without alcohol? And if I couldn't, why? What is it about? What am I trying? You know, is it because I don't feel like it's safe to be myself? Is there an anxiety there that I could, you know, It's we want to make sure that we can do the things that we feel that we can't do without the need for alcohol, you know.
Yeah.
And being able to, you know, being able to experiment with that, I think, is the really interesting thing. And I think a lot of the time as well, there's a lot, you know, I've definitely done this, but I think there's a lot of people that also probably do this. It's kind of, I think the term is like drunkorexia, where it's like you, and that is something that people, again, it's like making, when I went traveling, this is a really good example of it. When I went traveling in Australia, I basically lived for about 6 months with barely any food, but mostly alcohol. And it's one of those where I just thought, how was I alive? Mm-hmm. How did that happen? But there wasn't an option for me, because it was like, well, I can't, if I'm going to drink, I can't eat. It's cheating to eat, you know? And it's interesting that we have these little societal things of like eating, yes, cheating when it comes to a night out. And, you know, or, you know, if you think about somebody who is restricting, they go out for a night out and they allow themselves to end up at the chip shop in mm-hmm. at the end of the night, you know. And, you know, could you do that without alcohol? If not, why? Like, and the why obviously will be like the eating disorder. But what is it that it's all, what I'm trying to say is that I think that nobody knows what their path is until they start to tread on it, because that's when we discover and we learn and we allow ourselves to find out without, you know, these judgy, this is what I have to do, this is what this person's done, this is what I should do, etc., etc. But I'm really keen, for me, when I quit as well, but also for anybody that does quit, like, why do you, if you do feel like you've got a problematic relationship with alcohol, what's it serving? How is it helping you? Because it will be helping you, just as the eating disorder is trying to help you as well. It's trying to help us either deal with stuff that's happened in the past, or help us to kind of shrink down from being ourselves because maybe we feel like we're too much, or it's trying to help to level something that's going on in our chemistry and our brain. Like, there is always a purpose of keeping us safe in one way or another. So to demonize it and just be like, right, well, I'm not doing it, without learning those other coping mechanisms, having that recovery toolbox, you are just white knuckling it and putting yourself through more pain and the unnecessary pain than is needed.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting way to look at it, because I think you're so right in that the immediate reaction if somebody has a problematic relationship with alcohol is to just cut it out and maybe not explore what the alcohol is serving in terms of, you know, allowing you to navigate different situations. And I guess it's really difficult, because I think for a lot of people, you know, just stopping drinking is the easier thing to do. And I completely get that. But then I guess you need to give yourself that extra time to actually then work out what it's allowing you to navigate, and to also give yourself compassion in that if you do have a problematic relationship with alcohol and then you stop drinking, not only are you then going to be missing the alcohol, maybe for the social lubricant side of things, the taste of it, whatever, you know, whatever thing you liked, but you're also then not going to have that coping mechanism for those things that you've kind of not been able to feel like you can navigate without it. So then it's like a whole barrage of things. So I suppose then it's a really good time to start to think about other coping mechanisms that can support you. But I also think there's that added extra of, and again, I say it's similar to exercise, but I think that's probably because that's sort of how I relate to this, because I'd say that would be my addiction, is it is so normalized in society to, I think particularly, if I compare myself to my parents' generation is much more of like a, beer each evening, sort of when you get back from work, or glass of wine with dinner generation. Whereas my generation is like, don't drink for the whole week, and then you go out on a Saturday and absolutely send everything that you can see. But that binge drinking culture is so normalized, and it made me giggle. I did something really bad actually. I was on a skiing holiday, and we'd been skiing all day, and I was bloody hungry, as you would be. But I was like, no, I'm not letting my eating disorder win, because I had in my head like, I'm going to be going out later, and like when you're skiing and drink beer, and that was scary. And so I said to my partner, oh, would you mind? He was going back to the chalet. I was like, would you mind just getting me a protein bar? And I was really proud of myself for asking. And I asked in front of lots of people as well. So I was like, I'm really proud of myself. And one of my friends went, oh, Hannah, eating's cheating. And I was just like, oh, it's not cheating when you're recovering from anorexia. And my partner's mouth just hit the floor. But I was like, I probably shouldn't have said anything, but I was equally just like, comments like that are just not helpful for anybody. That was a massive tangent. But I think basically what I was trying to get to, I can't remember what I was saying. So that was just my tangent
Just the
story.
normalization of it.
Yes.
No, I love that. And you're right, though, because that it is so normalized. And I think when you do, I think what I was trying to say earlier as well is that I think if my relationship with alcohol wasn't the way that it was, I don't think I would have recovered from my eating disorder when I did. Like I needed that transition. Because I went from something way worse that was life-threatening into something that was a little bit more normalized, but still extremely problematic in the way of it. And at that point in my life, it was like, well, alcohol is so normalized. Like everybody drinks, you know? And if I didn't have that transition phase, and then obviously coming to the end of that when it started becoming even more of a problem than just like just in terms of the way that I approached that drinking. When I stopped drinking, I thought that there was going to be a really big wave of people asking if I was pregnant or asking if I, had a drinking problem or having an opinion or And I guess it, for me, not everybody has this, but I was quite lucky in that people just respected the fact that I said, I'm doing it for a challenge to myself, just to see if what happens in my life if I stop for a year. And by kind of 8 months in, nobody cared. I mean, nobody cared anyway. I think we worry that people will care a lot more than they actually do. But
People are so
the I guess.
self-obsessed. I always think with this sort of thing, like you think that they'll care, but actually they only care about, as long as they can still do what they want to do, they don't care what you're doing.
Exactly. If I was, preaching at everybody that why the reasons why everybody should stop drinking alcohol, maybe it would be different. But that's never really been what I've been like. I think there is a transitional phase where you are a little bit more, and I don't know if you found this. I found this with eating disorder recovery as well, and I see it in my clients a lot. And I definitely went through it, where you go through an eating disorder and then you get really angry about diet culture. And really angry about society and the way that society is with that just all diet culture stuff, and that this becomes this massive thing that you get really angry about. And then I always say with my clients, you get to a point where it's just like quiet confidence, where you don't need to be arguing with people about how problematic they are anymore, or why they shouldn't be saying that. There might be some things that it will still kind of trigger that in you. But generally, there's such a calmness about it. And I feel like that happens with alcohol as well, because you learn a lot about the way that alcohol works with the brain and all of that stuff. And the fact that, effectively, it's a drug, that it is a drug, it's a highly addictive drug. And then you get to a point where it's just like, yeah, it's just something I don't really do anymore. I can still go to a festival and dance like a crazy person. I can still stand on stage and rap the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air in front of hundreds of people. Like I'm more myself now without alcohol. And I think that was the thing I was running from a lot of the time was because I didn't really know who I was. I'd had an eating disorder for so long that I had to get to that point of really being okay with being who I was and learning how to cope with life and the uncomfortable parts. But we are told by society a lot of the time that, you know, this is what we do if we're, you know, and I was definitely in the binge drink. It was about how much you could drink. That was it. It was like how much you could drink, how fun you were. Those were the things definitely in my kind of youth as well. So yeah, I think it's hard to go against the grain if that is something that you want to do. But I do feel that I don't think my life would be where it is now if I hadn't stopped drinking. And that's just me personally.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I think so much of what you're saying translates into why an eating disorder exists, or at least it does for me, in terms of I don't think that I am enough. And therefore my eating disorder puts me in situations or like I perform behaviors that I think are going to make me feel enough. And I think alcohol does that, you know, it makes you maybe more confident or more outgoing. And then you feel that you can be enough for everybody around you. And I think, you know, it might numb experiences or emotions, and an eating disorder does that as well. And I think that's why the transition is quite, you know, from one behavior to the next could be problematic. But I also agree with you in that going from one behavior to the next isn't brilliant, but I think if it gives you the space to explore things whilst being able to cope but also improving things, I don't know whether it's not the worst thing in the world. But I kind of just wanted to ask you, because you mentioned it at the start and we didn't really like talk much about it, but you said that like your binge drinking was very similar to your experiences of bulimia in terms of like the binge purge cycle. And I just wondered if you could maybe expand on that a little bit more for the listeners.
Yeah, sure. So I used to use alcohol a lot when I was in the binge purge cycle. So it would make things easier for me, essentially, because
sorry to butt in. So you had the issue with drinking at the same time as the eating disorder. So I thought it came after.
Yeah, no, it developed in the worst stages of my bulimia. Mm-hmm. I was drinking a lot. So whenever I would binge, I would drink at the same mm-hmm. time, because I was very ritualistic when I went through my binges, because it would be like, you've got to go and buy three of everything. So that ended up being like three bottles of wine as well.
Okay.
So that kind of, because then it was more of a, it was just, it was, it turned into this ritualistic thing, but it was also a bit, it made the whole process easier because I wasn't really there. I was totally numbed out and just going through the motions. So it was a vehicle essentially for that cycle to keep going. But then when, and I think the thing that you were, what we talked about briefly was when I did stop, when I kind of came out of recovery and my relationship with food was getting better, there was that part of me that felt like I've got to have something. So I can't be too healthy because that's bad too. So I'm going to drink. But what I found when I drank, I would, you know, you kind of say you lose your inhibitions, or like, you know, the truthful you comes out, which I don't totally agree with, but it became an excuse. Because what I would end up doing was I'd drink so much that I would be it. I'd be ill because I drank so much. So that's what I meant when I said there's like a ghost of the eating disorder behavior.
Got you.
Because it would be like I would drink a bottle of wine while I was cooking dinner, and then I'd feel so ill after dinner because I had this whole bottle of wine, that I'd end up in that cycle. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't as It was a lot, and it took me a long time to realize that as well, because I think there was a huge part of me that didn't want to see that, because it was like, no, I'm better now. I've struggled against this for so long. I'm better now. And once I became more aware of it, that lessened, you know, a lot. But the numbing element of that was still what I was chasing for a long time, was just not being present, not thinking, just going to sleep, not having to be there. And I think that that is something that is quite common for people that do drink as a way of escaping. And those are the people that maybe do want to think about what this is serving in their lives. When we trained, what we were told really was that if you are in eating disorder recovery, then you shouldn't drink alcohol. There was kind of this idea that can really get in the way, especially if you are on, you know, antidepressants or that kind of, just because of the chemistry of everything going on. But then there is the argument of, but is that because of the calories, which I think is something that should be addressed and should be challenged. But I think it needs to be done in a really mindful way, because otherwise you might find that there is an element of just kind of trying to do everything at once and just getting overwhelmed and nothing sticking, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that has been my process with recovery. I was always, when I tried to do it years before, it was like, okay, we're just gonna like jump off the cliff and into the sea and whatever will happen, and gonna like strip off all my clothes and I'm just gonna be bare naked. And I think you do get to a point where you do have to do that, but often, you know, if you have to get to a point where you just like dive in and you just go and see what the world has to offer you. But I think like stripping off all the like coping mechanisms and stuff that you have can actually be quite detrimental, because you then just end up running back. Whereas if you, you know, unpack them gently and explore what they're serving you, you know, what's the meaning behind them, what things can't you maybe do, because, and then that's helping to navigate that, that's a much better approach, because then you're actually exploring it, you can put other things into place and you're not like quickly running back. But something I was thinking about there when you were saying about, like, you know, when you were training, you were told people should not drink alcohol. I completely agree in terms of the whole antidepressants thing. And actually I was just thinking, you know, if you did say to somebody, you know, maybe you shouldn't be drinking whilst you're in recovery from alcohol, because it could act as sort of a different coping mechanism. Again, this is probably just my perspective because of the reason I'm fearful of alcohol. But you don't necessarily have to drink alcohol in order to have a drink that has calories in it. I don't know. I think I'm just thinking about this very much aloud, but it would almost for me be more scary to drink, let's say, a non-alcoholic drink, like I was saying before, that has calories in it, because for me it's like, okay, I can allow myself to have this drink because it's going to make me feel better. But if I'm going to have this drink and then it's not going to make me feel better, it's just I'm having this to be present in a social situation, but it kind of tastes like alcohol, then my brain would just be like, well, what's the point? That's wasted calories. So in a way, I feel like that could be a way to navigate that in a pro-recovery way, more than having the alcoholic drink, if your concern is, well, I can't stop drinking because I need to get over the fear of calories.
Yeah, I think doing lots of different experiments like it, like that, is really useful. And, you know, some people might recover and they have a perfectly healthy relationship with alcohol, where they enjoy the times that they drink, they don't have any regrets from when they were drinking. You know, they're able to remember their night, they're able to leave it when they, you know, it doesn't become something that they need. That is very possible for a lot of people. But I think the real key with all of it is like, what's behind it, and is that addressed? Has that has that been addressed, or is that something you're ready to address? Because I think that a lot of the time we think of recovery as this one thing that happens and then everything's fine again. And the reality is that recovery doesn't make life suddenly easy, but it helps us to give us the tools to deal with it when it's shit. Sorry for the line, but no, essentially no. that's what recovery does. And that's the same if you're looking at recovery from, you know, a shopping addiction or a gambling addiction or an alcohol addiction. We can be addicted to a lot of different things. We can be physically addicted or mentally addicted to things that have no physical, like, actual stuff going on that is deemed as addictive. And I think that is what tells us what we need to know. If we can be addicted to something like shopping, then it's that dopamine stuff that we're trying to get to. And it's, you know, if we find ourselves that we have this addictive personality that we want, if we want to label it as something in our lives, then what is that doing? What is that helping with? What is that numbing? You know, and can we give ourselves the tools to be able to deal with those things without the need to put a plaster over it for a little bit of time? And I think, you know, if it is kind of the calories element of it, then challenging that with liquid calories, milkshake, being able to kind of try and challenge that in many different ways, as well as challenging it with alcohol, if that's something that is a part of your life. Depending on what stage of life you're at, alcohol becomes more or less important. I'm in my 30s now. I have a 2-year-old. It's not really, I mean, there is a bit of like mum culture, kind of mums who gin, I can't remember what it's called. There's like a gin wine mummy or something, like, you know, mums who drink. It's like a thing. Like,
that sounds really, but that's a healthy, not that group to be part of.
Well, you know, it's just how people cope. Believe me, with the toddler, there are many times when I think, God, it would be much easier if I could not be here right now in my mind. But the thing is that, like, I'm at a stage in my life where I don't go out on nights out with friends. It's just not. But if you're in recovery when you're in your 20s, or you've got a group of friends that are very much like, that's how you get together and you care and you love and you want to be with those friends, then allow yourself to experiment. Go on a night out without alcohol, try the alcohol-free stuff, see how that feels. Go on a night out with alcohol, see how that feels. And then see it as like, okay, well, which one did I enjoy more? Which one did I feel better than I, like, allow yourself to experiment. Because I think that's the thing. When we are somebody who does struggle with any kind of addiction, there is a part of us that's very black and white. I'm either doing it well or I'm doing it bad. I'm either in recovery or I'm relapsing. I'm either, you know, and actually what we need to stop doing is giving ourselves these black and white yes or no's and going, okay, how do I feel right now? Like, allow ourselves to make mistakes, allow ourselves not to be defined by the choices that we make in kind of little increments, and instead just go, right, can I be more compassionate to myself and allow myself to experiment with this? And then some of that fear automatically goes away, because you can't make a bad mistake.
Yeah, I think you're so right there. And I think that the black and white thinking translates so much in eating disorders. Like you say, I'm either doing well in recovery or I'm relapsing, or, you know, I'm either not having this food or I'm going to eat all of it. Like, it's very, very common. And it's actually because my brother went sober for a while, and he has recently just started having like the occasional pint. And before, that wasn't something that he could do, whereas now he is able to have the occasional pint. He has one pint and then he's done it and he's happy with that. And we were having a conversation about our relationship with alcohol, and I said to him, like, once I start drinking, I don't really feel like I can stop. And he said that, you know, you can have that relationship with it. And he said for him that was more difficult than cutting it out completely, was finding that sweet spot of having one or two. And I'm not saying that that's going to be the most difficult for for everybody, and I guess for some people, like finding that sweet spot just might not be a possibility. It might be that you do need to kind of just cut it out. But I think it's, like you say, it's so important that you experiment with it. And I think just from my perspective, in terms of a lot of eating disorders revolve around restriction, just being able to be flexible with this and experiment with it, like you said, you know, if you get to the point where you don't want to have a drink anymore, and that is purely for your good intentions, and you can be honest with yourself, absolutely fantastic. But if it comes a situation where you do want to have one, two, three drinks with your friends, and you know, you're having a nice time, that's also totally fine. I think it's when that eating sort of voice starts creeping in terms of, you know, oh, you know, this is a slippery slope, or you've had way too many, or you've not had enough, or things like that. I think you can, personally, for me, I think I know when that inner critic is coming in and when that eating disorder is trying to drive my decisions, compared to, I'm going to make this decision for me right now, and actually, I don't fancy a gin and tonic right now, or yeah, I do fancy one, and that's totally okay as well.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's 100% it as well. And I think that that's the, I find the transference so interesting, because actually I think a lot of people, I've seen it, you know, I've been involved in lots of like the sober community for a long time now. And it's really interesting to see when somebody quits drinking, they change everything. So they will automatically go to the gym, eat like really, really healthily, and try and like upgrade their entire life because of health. But as a result, what quite often happens is that they do start to translate that all or nothing mentality that they had with alcohol into food. So, you know, I've spoken to plenty of people that they'll kind of say, oh, you know, once I open a packet of biscuits, it all goes. Like, I don't have moderation. I didn't have it with alcohol. I don't have it with food. But that, I think, in itself is, I think our triggers are an opportunity to understand a bit more about ourselves. I personally don't think that anything is fixed for us. We have the way that our bodies work, and the way that our beliefs mold our actions and our thoughts and our behaviors, and the fact that we can change those beliefs if we work on them. I think that that's really interesting, and it's such an opportunity for us. But it's just about whether we're ready for that, and if we actually want that. And if we don't, then that's fine. If you're, you know, if you're at a point where it's like, you know, I have recovered, I'm able to eat how I never thought I could eat, but I do find that I do tend to overdrink. Let that be that. And when you're ready to address it, if that becomes something you want to address, then you're going to come at it in such a better place, instead of being like, oh, now I've got this, now I've got this, because otherwise it just feels really heavy. I remember when I went through my eating disorder, it was like I had my eating disorder, and then I had this crippling anxiety, and it was like, God's sake, like I've just got over this thing, now I've got to deal with my anxiety. And then when I kind of had come to the realization that actually my drinking was probably causing a lot of my anxiety issues, and that maybe I should stop drinking, I ended up realizing that I was like, oh, great, now there's another thing I have to deal with. But I think when you change that, oh, great, it's always me. Oh, I'm always going to struggle. Oh, like when you can change that into, this is interesting, that changes the way that it feels like it has power over you. And that's when you can actually start to make strides, because it's done in such a different way.
Yeah, and I think that that example that you've just given there goes back to what we were saying before about, you know, a transition from eating disorder to alcohol, or eating disorder to anxiety, or whatever. It kind of just says to me that maybe you've resolved some things, but you haven't resolved everything, and there's still some things that you're trying to navigate, and maybe your brain is not doing it in the kindest way possible to you, but that gives you an opportunity to explore that. And I think, obviously, you know, I'm not saying that going, you know, feeling anxious all the time or whatever is a wonderful experience, because I know that it's not. But I think, like you said, just changing that perspective rather than, oh, you know, it's always me, I'm always struggling with something. It's like, okay. And this is hard to do. I'm not saying that this is easy, but like, here's an, you know, this is the next step on my journey, and I'm gonna unpick this, and that means that in the future, like, things will be better. Obviously, it'd be better if you just got to the end of your eating disorder and everything was tickety boo, but I think it just shows you that there maybe is more to unpack, and that's totally okay.
Yeah, because life's always going to happen to us, and I think that the more that you understand yourself and how you navigate the world, the more that you're going to thrive in it. And I think that being able to have a completely clear mind from not drinking, I realized that not being able to switch off was one of my big things, and it was exhausting. And that's where EFT has been really helpful for me, because it does help me just to, you know, let the stuff that's going in my head literally just go. I can feel a lot, I feel a lot calmer in myself. But there was also the shadow of I'm not good enough. And I think, and that was the driving factor for my eating disorder, and that was strong. But it's like, it got weaker and weaker as it came, as it transitioned through those phases. And now, you know, largely I can sit and I say I am good enough. Like I'm worthy of having a really good life. And there are maybe parts of my life that maybe it shows up every now and then. It's like, but it's like, oh, okay, you're back, you're trying here. But you know what? I see you, and maybe there's something in me that feels a little bit uncertain. Let's talk to that part of myself instead of just kind of continuing to beat myself up with the belief that I'm always going to have this, because it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to that all or nothing nature, doesn't it? Like, you know, if I have an eating disorder thought, then that means that I've got an eating disorder again, but actually that's not true. It's how you then navigate and how you respond to that thought. You know, if you have that thought and then you restrict your food intake, then okay, even maybe if you do it once, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're back to where you started. If it continues, then maybe it needs some looking at. But those thoughts probably, if we're being honest, will pop up, but it's how we navigate them going forwards that I think makes the difference as to whether I'm still engaging with an eating disorder or whether it's a thought that's popped up because you're going through a challenging situation and, oh no, I've got my recovery toolbox here and I can whack out something that I know is going to help me rather than tapping into the eating disorder.
Yeah, and I think that is really important to say as well a lot, because, you know, I think when you I'm in a really privileged position where I've been recovered for about 10 years, and so it's sometimes quite easy for me to paint things in this really like simplistic way, and I know from experience it really isn't like that. I struggled for a long time, but it is about how you navigate. It's not about the fact that life suddenly becomes really easy or you never have those things again. After I had my son, I struggled a lot with intrusive thoughts. And one of my thoughts was, if I eat, he's going to die. And like, that makes no sense, absolutely no sense. And I do think that there is that part that may be slightly an eating disorder element to that. But I acknowledged that I felt like that, and I didn't let it become bigger than it needed to be. I just let it become a passing thought. And I was able to navigate using all the tools that I have so that it didn't even need to be something that was like, uh-oh, is it coming back? Uh-oh, like, am I going to struggle? It was just like, huh, that's a really weird thing to pop in. Like, I wonder what's going on. And what was going on was I was absolutely shattered. But, you know, it's really important to make that point, because whether we're always going to be navigating life and our relationship to life whether that be our relationship with exercise, food, alcohol, our bodies, people around us. We are in relationship all the time, and we need to be in relationship because that's connection, and that's part of the reason why we are here, to connect and to be part of life. So we're always going to come against challenges and rocky patches, but it's just about how we navigate through with the tools that we develop and that we learn and we gather as we go through it, that, and that's the stuff that makes the difference.
Yeah, and I suppose with that in mind, like if you do get a disordered thought when you think that you're, you know, swimming along in life pretty fine, it is sort of like a warning sign of, oh, maybe things aren't quite right here. Like, what else is going on for me right now? Why do I think that it's, you know, a good time to lean into those behaviors? And maybe do I need to give myself a bit more self-care or a bit more compassion, or really lean into what I'm experiencing at the moment to look after myself, rather than my natural instinct, which might have been that, you know, what actually is going on and how can I explore that?
Yeah, and reminding yourself that you are not your thoughts,
mm-hmm.
that your thoughts don't determine your actions. They don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you can make that, it can be just as interesting to watch your thoughts and without giving them any meaning, you know, and allowing yourself just to check in. I think that's really, that can be quite a powerful kind of thing to remind yourself as well. You know, it could be a calling, it could be there's something to look into, but we can also give ourselves permissions just to acknowledge it as it's just a thought, and that thought doesn't define who I am. It has no bearing on what I do, and I don't need to give it any more energy than it's just taken up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was like feeling really anxious the other day, and I was chatting to my mum, and then I just got to the point and I was like, stop, these are just thoughts, they're taking up too much space, I don't want them anymore, let's move on. And it was really funny how I was all of a sudden just like, this isn't even real, I'm just gonna move on right now. But Emily, thank you so much. It has been so lovely to chat to you. I feel like we explored so much today. I think it's going to be a really, really useful episode. Where can people go to find out more about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, so I am on Instagram. I'm probably most active on Instagram generally. So I'm at We Are Mind Body. Same on TikTok, and my website is www.wearemindbody.co.uk. So yeah, I have clarity calls if people want to either know more about the work that I do, or if they want to work with me. And yeah, just send me a message and we can go from there.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. It's been so lovely to speak to you again.
It's been great to be back. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.